I'm Christopher Brooke. That doesn't matter. yesterday, in the afternoon, we had the University College London panel, and this panel is the Southern California panel. We've got Shauna Shiffrin from the University of California at Los Angeles, who will be speaking on justice, equality, and incentives. And then Dick Arneson of UC San Diego will be commenting. And so, when you're ready, Shauna, take it away.
All right. Well, I'm soft-spoken, so let's just check and make sure this works, yeah? Can you hear me in the back? Yeah? Good. So my title's changed. The official title is now Incentives, Motives, and Talents, and the unofficial title is Rescuing Jerry from the Basic Structure Objection. And this is my environmentally correct handout. Jerry's influence on the field and on me has been profound. He routinely vindicates some of philosophy's most central ambitions, to face hard and elusive questions with a combination of foreground confidence, tempered by compassion, humility, humor, high standards, intellectual honesty, creativity, and precision. I'm grateful to him for his rigorous demands and loving support as my graduate supervisor, and more broadly, for offering all of us a model of doing philosophy that's both serious and joyful. I hope to engage in a more specific form of tribute by elaborating a position inspired by his work on labor incentives. My argument aims at many of Jerry's conclusions, but our methodological and substantive differences may be substantial enough that we arrive only at some destinations together, and even then only as fellow travelers. But I'll start with a point of appreciation regarding some common methodological ground that Jerry tilled early on. Then I will articulate a different version of the labor incentives argument that's inspired by Jerry but differs substantially in form and somewhat in extension. Whereas Jerry investigates the application of the difference principle directly to citizens in a well-ordered society, I think the main fruit may be picked by identifying the implications of citizens accepting the justifications for the difference principle. As I develop this position, my approach avoids much of the controversy about the basic structure, and it handles the demandingness objection in a very different way. My jumping-off point is my admiration for Jerry's sustained and original pursuit of a version of what I like to call the substantive virtue theory of political philosophy, a methodology that's particularly evident in the Tanner lectures. By using the term substantive virtue theory, I do not refer to a political analog of what's often called virtue ethics. Although Jerry does claim that some elements of the ethos cannot be codified, I don't take him to endorse anything like the view that justice is that which the just person would do or that which just people would elect. Indeed, Jerry's criticism of constructivism leads him far from positions of this kind. But not all virtue theory, whether in ethics or in politics, has meta-ethical commitments of the sort often associated with virtue ethics. I take substantive virtue theory to involve an investigation of the habits, dispositions, attitudes, and behaviors that individuals must develop, foster, and express given the ethical and political principles that govern them and given their commitments to these principles. Substantive virtue theory begins with certain principles taken to be correct and then investigates their penumeral power. Assuming these principles are correct, it asks what implications they have beyond how they directly and explicitly regulate for those who may be expected to comply with, accept, and support the implementation of those principles. Substantive virtue theory is especially attentive to the institutional, social, and psychological contexts and relationships in which such principles are to be implemented, as well as the hazards humans often encounter when implementing such principles. Identifying these implications in such contexts involves asking such questions as, first, if a particular principle X applies, what character traits, beliefs, and behavior will be necessary for the reliable realization of X's directives? For instance, if there's a moral rule against using violence to express and exercise one's irritation, this may imply that agents have duties not simply to refrain from violent outbursts, but also to cultivate dispositions of restraint, techniques of anger management, and habits of conflict avoidance to avoid succumbing to predictable temptations to engage in violence. Second, if principle X holds and a publicity condition applies, does the acceptance of the principle and its justifications have implications for any other principles and agents and institutions should accept? Further, are there other behaviors, attitudes, and dispositions agents should develop to implement the foundational principle and its progeny under publicity conditions, by which I mean conditions in which the principles are known, accepted, and known to be known and accepted? Are there some behaviors, attitudes, motives, or dispositions that are inconsistent with these principles and therefore could not ground claims, rights, or duties? The second methodological move I just described may be somewhat less familiar, so I'll offer a somewhat extended example of its use, inspired by Jerry's work, but in a different context than that of labor incentives, which will be my main topic for today. As I've argued elsewhere, the acceptance of a free speech principle and its justifications implies that citizens should not make claims for the exercise of state authority that are based on a desire that others should not evince non-libelous criticism of them, their views, or their speech. An acceptance of a free speech principle is inconsistent with the idea that state authority should be exerted to suppress criticism, or for that matter, to suppress expressions of agreement or consensus. Therefore, if the source of the demand for intellectual property protection is that creators do not wish to create unless they will have the legal power to suppress a particular highly effective form of criticism involving sampling, that motive is inconsistent with their internalization of the free speech principle. If creators do not wish to create unless they will have the legal power to suppress expressions of agreement because creators want to be the exclusive articulators of a position or because they do not want rivals, those motives would also be inconsistent with their internalization of the free speech principle and its justifications. If the free speech principle and its justifications are public, then in a well-ordered society, those motives would not operate in citizens and could not ground a reasonable claim for the exercise of state authority. Whatever case for intellectual property is to be made, it cannot rest directly or implicitly on claims that it is appropriate to censor speech because its content is unwelcome. I subscribe to this methodology, and I believe, as I just indicated, that its scope ranges beyond the context of labor incentives in which Jerry originally developed it. As I was just suggesting, it may help to illuminate dilemmas about the tension between freedom of speech and incentive arguments for intellectual property. I believe analysis of this form also underlies a number of arguments for free speech protections. For example, an argument for free association may flow from considering the value of free speech as residing in part in the development of free thought alongside the sort of context in which people are enabled to engage in sophisticated, complex, and safe reflection and inquiry. For like reasons, I believe this methodology undergirds the best form of the so-called penumbra argument for the substantive due process privacy protections articulated in Griswold versus Connecticut and Roe versus Wade. Briefly, if we accept the free speech principle and its justifications, we have to provide for safe and productive havens for thought expression, confidence sharing, and mutual influence. And given what we're like, this is going to have to include the ability to select with whom and in what ways one will share fundamental forms of intimacy. These preliminary detours about freedom of speech and U.S. constitutional law are meant merely to underscore that I regard Jerry's use of substantive virtue theory in his arguments about the internal tensions of economic incentive arguments as powerful and inspirational. But over the years, I've come to see from reading him and his critics that I understand his basic criticism of the incentives argument in a way that differs from the manner in which he tends now to present it and to which his critics tend to respond. So I'll turn now to present an alternative formulation of the incentives argument that I'll diffidently suggest has more power in some respects than the formulation Jerry relies on for his ad hominem argument. For rhetorical ease, I will contrast my formulation with a canonical formulation of Jerry's, but I should note that I internalized Jerry's early remarks on incentives to suggest my formulation. Whether or not the canonical version is indeed Jerry's official position, it's a commonly discussed version of the argument, and the contrast between it and my formulation is, I think, illuminating. In the canonical version, Jerry argues that the difference principle, in some sense, applies directly to individuals. Therefore, in a well-ordered society, citizens could not coherently demand higher salaries to perform more productive work on the grounds that such higher salaries would benefit the least well-off. If a citizen internalizes the difference principle and applies it to her own economic activity, then she will only demand an equal salary to others, and she will perform as productively as possible in as productive an occupation as possible in order to maximize the position of the least well-off Jerry does allow for the possibility of just higher compensation for more burdensome employment, but attributes the resultant permissible inequalities in social primary goods to inadequacies in Rawls's account to the content of the social primary goods metric, rather than to the justice of inequality produced by incentives. A properly constructed primary goods metric would include a measure of sensitivity to labor burden, but absent greater labor burden, individuals in a just society would not demand higher remuneration to perform more productive work. This strategy of argument has generated a great deal of resistance about the basic structure and whether the difference principle applies exclusively to it or whether it has wider applications. It has also given rise to demandingness objections, including that it's overly demanding for each citizen to subordinate her personal interests and occupational preference and work style and her personal projects and relationships in order to, at all points and times, maximize the position of the least well-off. In response, Jerry has embarked on an ambitious project to show that the principles applying to the basic structure have continuous application to the individuals in them, albeit tempered by an orthogonal cross-cutting personal prerogative. I submit that the basic structure controversy renders Jerry's points about salary incentives more controversial than they need be and submerges some of the important issues about equality. So here I want to rerun the argument in another way that sidesteps the basic structure debate. Instead of arguing the difference principle, or a closely configured cognate, directly regulates citizens and thereby precludes most standard calls for and uses of incentives in employment markets, my version of the argument relies instead on the public's acceptance of a major underpinning of the difference principle, namely the claim that talents are arbitrary from a moral point of view. The acceptance of this justificatory underpinning of the difference principle itself precludes most standard uses of incentives that yield inequalities. My formulation yields Jerry's main conclusions about equality without engendering the controversies that exercise its critics. Hence, it would allow Jerry to rescue equality while traveling rather lighter. It also offers a more unified picture of the relation between Jerry's fundamental critique and the accommodation of concerns about demandingness. Let me elaborate. In the Rawlsian well-ordered society, members accept the two principles and their justifications. Although it's not frequently discussed, the acceptance of the justifications for the principles is an important component of the publicity condition and one I will make weight of. The major justification of the difference principle is that distributions of social primary goods should not reflect factors that are arbitrary from a moral point of view. Among a group of well-motivated cooperators, the ability to demand a higher wage on the market because one has a unique skill is arbitrary from a moral point of view. Because I understand this justification in a different way than some commentators seem to, I'm going to dwell on this to detail my understanding of the point. First, as I understand it, the idea that talents are arbitrary from a moral point of view is not to say simply or mainly that their possession is a matter of luck or chance. For one thing, our talents are not arbitrary from a moral point of view, full stop. They are arbitrary from a moral point of view with respect to income and wealth and with respect to the basic liberties as well. But they are not arbitrary, at least in Rawls's view, with respect to occupations and other positions of power, although the very same talents, whether chosen or unchosen, are at issue. This can be inferred from the structure of the fair equality of opportunity principle. That principle ensures that occupations are equally available to all. I'm sorry, that principle does not ensure that occupations are equally available to all, or that we each have equal opportunities to gain access to them. That's what you would expect if talents were arbitrary with respect to occupation. Instead, the fair equality of opportunity principle guarantees similar opportunity to those with like talents and like willingness to make an effort, thereby making what talents one has relevant to what opportunities should be in reach. With respect to occupation, what is arbitrary from a moral point of view are things like class origin, race, gender, ethnicity, and religion. But what talents I have are not arbitrary with respect to the distribution of occupations, in part because what occupation I'm well suited to perform, and therefore how I may usefully contribute to the joint product of social cooperation, depends in part on what I'm able to do. And further, the degree to which a particular occupation allows me to realize my potential and to satisfy the Aristotelian principle, and therefore, in what way the occupation can serve as a good for me, depends on what my talents are. And so in this context, my talents are germane. But my talents are arbitrary with respect to what claims I have on the joint social product to which I contribute. Each of us has an interest in income and wealth because they allow us access to those resources and opportunities that promote the exercise of our higher order capacity to develop and pursue a conception of the good. We each possess this capacity, and it's partly in virtue of our mutual possession of this capacity that we are to regard ourselves as equal. That capacity does not vary in strength or importance in virtue of what talents we happen to possess or whether those talents happen to be in market demand. So the ability of this capacity to generate claims for shares of the joint social product does not increase or diminish depending on what talents I happen to possess. This feature is what grounds the initial presumption of equality of distribution and of income and wealth. Moreover, the development of my abilities into socially valued talents has socially determined components in two ways. First, what abilities, skills, and qualities can serve our project of social cooperation is largely a product of our circumstances and methods of social organization. In some social and geographical settings, tall stature serves social purposes and may command social interest, whether because of tall trees from which to gather fruit or because of an interest in basketball. In other contexts, digital agility may matter, whether because we need close-knit textiles because it's so cold or we need fast typists. In some contexts, mental agility may be quite salient, whereas in others, physical strength may matter more. Second, the development of native potential into realized ability that garners social interest usually depends mightily on personal investments of time and effort, as well as social investments of cultivation, teaching, nurturing, etc. That these social investments happen to be in my immediate possession is also arbitrary from a moral point of view. My immediate possession does not give me any special claim to their fruits any more than the immediate possession by a cashier of money for goods gives her special claim to those funds. Now, on this account, our equal interest in pursuing a conception of the good motivates the initial presumption of an equal distribution of income and wealth and explains why talent is arbitrary with respect to income and wealth. Because it's arbitrary, it cannot serve as a reason for an unequal distribution. Now, if I accept that my talents in these respects are morally arbitrary with respect to the product of joint social cooperation, that fact alone, whether or not the difference of principle directly regulates me, that fact alone would have to influence how I bargain for salary in an employment context. This will be true even if I reject the idea that it's my personal direct responsibility to ensure the least well-off or as well-off as possible, and if I instead accept the claim that that particular responsibility should be discharged through the intelligent design of a basic structure. I'll illustrate this point with an analogous example concerning race. My racial classification is entirely arbitrary with respect to my interest in and claim upon all the social primary goods. One's legitimate expectations for primary goods surely do not vary depending on one's race. Suppose the basic structure bans racial discrimination entirely and aims to secure fair equality of opportunity for all citizens in addition, aiming in part to eradicate the influence of race on citizens' social prospects. As Jerry points out, it may still be the case that the collective's ability to eradicate the influence of arbitrary factors through the direct and indirect effects of legislation and institutional design may still be limited. Racism may persist and exert influence in ways that are difficult to police. Now, suppose I'm a citizen who believes in the distinction between the principles that govern the basic structure and the principles governing individual citizens. I might then take it that the basic structure must be designed to eradicate racism and provide fair equality of opportunity. I might recognize my obligation to support and comply with such institutions, but still believe that I need not make it among my personal ends or one of the constraints regulating my pursuit of my ends, that where possible, all of my actions actively work to eradicate racism or advance fair equality of opportunity. Nor need the eradication of racism take lexical priority over all my other ends. But still, if I accept the justification behind the two principles, I cannot attempt to leverage race to gain advantage in economic relations. So suppose I'm offered a job in a workplace that predominantly has and traditionally has had people of my ethnicity or racial background. Even if I do not regard myself as governed directly by the anti-discrimination and fair opportunity principles that govern the basic structure, nonetheless, I could not consistently request that my salary be 10% higher than all other workers in the firm who have a different racial classification. Such a request would be inconsistent with my acceptance of the justificatory principle that race is a morally arbitrary factor with respect to income and wealth and the general methods of dividing our joint social product. I would be treating my race as a reason that I should be paid more, which is inconsistent with acknowledging that it cannot function as a reason of that sort. I would be attempting to leverage a feature that I regard as morally arbitrary and I regard as irrelevant to the proper ordering of a social distribution. For similar reasons, I'd be precluded from requesting a higher salary if I gathered in the course of interviewing that the employer had a special fondness for me because of our shared racial identity, and if consequently I believed that my request would be granted because of the special affection. Even if the employer were unaware of his implicit racism, I couldn't ask for a higher salary if I believed it would be granted, intentionally or not, because the employer valued what I regard as an irrelevant feature that should not influence people's economic prospects. If we're to treat possession of talents as arbitrary factors with respect to one's claim on the joint social product, just as we're to treat race, then similarly, I should not ask for, nor take advantage of, higher salaries offered on account of my possession of a favored talent. Given equal labor burden, I should not demand more than an equal distribution principle would deliver, merely because I know I have leverage due to my unique talent or productivity. And importantly, employers should not offer higher salaries, for they would be treating my talents as though they offered reasons for compensation when in fact they do not. This articulation of the critique of incentives differs in two related ways from the strategy that calls for the direct internalization of the difference principle, first in the form of reasoning that's deployed, and second in the extension of the relevant principle. So, acceptance that talents are morally arbitrary limits what reasons a citizen may act on, as opposed to Jerry's strategy, which is to require that the agent advance a particular end, namely the maximal benefit of the least well-off. My limitation on the reasons a citizen in a well-ordered society may act on may in turn benefit the least well-off, but the connection to the position of the least well-off is indirect. Acceptance of this idea does not independently provide me with a charge that I must contribute personally to contributing to the position of the least well-off. The difference in scope may also be brought out by a further variation on the case. If I decline a position because I prefer another, although my performing the former position would maximize the position of the least well-off, my occupational choice may not run afoul of the internalization of the arbitrariness argument. Suppose I have the same range of occupational choices as others do, that is, the same number of choices and a similar variety of types of occupation, where this measure is sensitive to relatively objective measures of labor burden, like difficulty, physical and mental challenge, monotony, schedule, degree of personal interaction, and transparent effectiveness. But in my set of choices is an occupation whose performance would improve the position of the least well-off more than other options. If I turn it down because another position subjectively appeals to me more, I have not, directly or indirectly, acted in a way that takes advantage of a relevant power or opportunity that I arbitrarily possess because of my talent. And so I've not violated the arbitrariness strategy, though I may have violated Jerry's strategy. Now, suppose that having turned down this position, I'm reoffered it for more money. The renewed sweetened offer is motivated by the social desire to elicit the relevant work for the least well-off in light of my refusal. May I permissibly take the incentive to do the job? No. I may permissibly take the job, I may permissibly decline it. Neither choice would amount to or be motivated by an illicit use of a power I have by virtue of what I should regard as happenstance with respect to income and wealth. But my ability to garner more income and wealth than others is a pure product of my arbitrary possession, and it would be impermissible for me to treat my possession of this talent as though it gave me a warrant for higher income. So this example may bring out some differences between my approach and Jerry's. On Jerry's account, there's a prima facie problem with declining the job that better serves the least well-off because it's inconsistent with internalizing the difference principle. On my view, there's no such problem. Declining does not involve treating one's personal talents as a personal asset to generate income. Jerry's view is then tempered by the invocation of a personal prerogative. Mine is not. I'll say more about this later. On Jerry's view, this prerogative in some circumstances may, depending on the prerogative size and the degree of subjective burden, justify turning down the job or justify accepting the enhanced salary for performing it. On my view, declining in the situation described violates no commitment of justice, but accepting the enhanced salary always does. So, on my account, inequality generated by talent incentives should not transpire, at least so long as the incentives are consciously offered and accepted as such, or transparently in some way. So, but then, this means that work that could benefit all of us may not be performed. There may be a higher ratio of gardeners to doctors than is optimal, and salary incentives will not be a viable option to address the problem, although presumably there will be a limit to the number of gardening positions that the market will bear. Jerry addresses the problem by applying the difference principle to individuals, which would then influence their occupational choice through the ethos, but not through enforcement. I just accept that our hands may be tied in this way, although, of course, the principles of justice may require a certain level of contribution to the joint enterprise, and other principles like those of beneficence may operate here as well. This does not imply, however, that my account condemns all Pareto improvements that result in income inequality. So, suppose we work within an equal distribution scheme, calibrated to include labor burden, and produce a net product of X. We live perfectly fine, comfortable, fulfilling lives. We are aware that we could all work harder or more productively without strain, and after compensating for increased labor costs and burdens, we would produce X plus Y. But that this is near the boundary of what we're capable of without strain. Y, the surplus, spread equally, would give each of us little benefit and wouldn't motivate us to alter our way of life to work harder. But Y, enjoyed by a subset of us, would allow for a satisfying splurge like a lovely vacation. It would not create overt ongoing differences in our qualities of life of the sort that contribute to tensions and other sorts of relational defects. We'd all be willing to put in the extra effort to produce X plus Y if Y were distributed to a subset chosen randomly, whether because each of us wanted the chance at a vacation or because we liked the idea that some of us would enjoy this special good. Such a case does not meet the strictures of the non-Lexi-Maximin interpretation of the difference principle, but it would satisfy Lexi-Maximin and seems prima facie acceptable. Because the provision of the additional reward does not hinge on the exercise of any particular party's talent, but is rather distributed randomly, it does not seem to conflict with the internalization of the arbitrariness argument. Now, you might wonder, why doesn't this scheme violate a general stricture on inequalities attributable to arbitrary causes? What could be more arbitrary than winning a lottery? Well, my diffident suggestion, which partly reinforces my earlier point that arbitrary does not directly refer to that caused by luck, is as follows. We all have an interest in the extra income, but only delivered in lumps, so we cannot all enjoy the extra income we all have an interest in. An equal distribution serves no purpose, assuming the inequality does not create relational tensions. Given that we all have an equal interest in the scarce good, by giving each of us an equal chance, a randomizing procedure responds to our equal interest in a way that choosing on the basis of a quality, like talent or contribution level, would not. Choosing on the basis of a quality would suggest that there's something about one of us or some of us that merits or justifies our receipt of the good in particular, whereas a randomizing procedure makes no such suggestion. So, let me turn now to an important set of cases about which Jerry's account offers a clear set of answers, whereas mine may not. I've been arguing that it does not violate the difference principle or its suppositions to decline a position that would maximize the position of the least well-off if one's range of options were comparable to others. But the situation might be otherwise if, by virtue of my talent, I have a greater range of varied opportunities than others. What it will depend upon is partly how we're to understand occupations and positions of power, and in what way they're social primary goods, and whether a range of choices should be understood as a primary good. Although what talents one possesses may not be arbitrary with respect to any particular position of employment, as Paola argued yesterday, one's interest in having a range of occupations from which to choose may be a good with respect to which one's talents are arbitrary. So if I turn down an adequate position that serves the least well off to take a more personally rewarding position for which others do not have comparable opportunities, I might be said to act contrary to my acceptance that talents are arbitrary from a moral point of view, because now I would be taking advantage of an opportunity that others do not have and gaining advantage because of a feature that's arbitrary from a moral point of view. Now, this case is not simple. As I mentioned, it depends on an expansion of the primary goods metric that I'm sympathetic to on some objective lines, because I think it resounds with some of the themes sounded in Rawls's discussion of the Aristotelian principle, but it adds a lot of complexity to the primary goods metric that partly cuts against the motivation for that metric in the first place. Second, this case raises a question about exactly how acceptance of the idea that talents are arbitrary from a moral point of view should constrain our behavior. In this case, unlike the others I've discussed so far, the good to which you have special access is not one that you seek or accept on insupportable grounds. You're not making a claim to a good that relies on grounds you agree are arbitrary. You've not attempted to gain advantage over others actively using tools whose possession is arbitrary from a moral point of view. Rather, there just is a range of occupations one's offered, and intrinsically, the particular job or the range intrinsically is not inconsistent with the internalization of arbitrariness. It just happens because of what others have access to, that in this context in which the offer is made, the offer has arisen only in light of a quality that's arbitrary from a moral point of view. And this raises the question of whether internalization of the arbitrariness argument requires that not only do you abstain from seeking to gain by actively using factors that are arbitrary, but does it also require that you be vigilant to uncover and refuse any benefits that come your way that have a causal history that refers to factors that are arbitrary from a moral point of view? And this will now bring us to some issues about demandingness that arise in the context of the incentives argument. And I think it's useful to distinguish between two different demandingness problems that lurk behind Jerry's position on labor incentives. The first demandingness problem is that Maxie Min, as a principle applied to individuals, confronts difficulties that are quite similar to the difficulties confronted by utilitarianism. It, like utilitarianism, is fully directive. That is, for any decision you could make, assuming there are no ties, it yields a very specific requirement about how you are to act. If among the actions you could take, one has a better effect on the position of the least well-off, it is what you are to take, no matter how great the cost to you or how small the impact on the least well-off. And this may be thought to be over-demanding on the individual because the ubiquity of opportunities to advance an end that may never be satisfied because the least well-off can always be made better off precludes the development and pursuit of other significant ends for compliant citizens. the interest in creating an environment in which compliant citizens may pursue their own independent ends may in part contribute to the basic structure objection, on the one hand, or on the other hand, in part contributes to Jerry's alternative strategy of acknowledging a personal prerogative. Now, notice that the account I offered does not evoke the basic structure objection. It does not rely on the claim that the difference principle directly applies to individuals. At the same time, it coheres with a fundamental insight of Jerry's, namely that the difference principle has direct implications for the behavior of individual citizens. But because the difference principle does not directly apply to them, rather the justifications is what gives rise to the implications for the motives that drive individual action. The justification, namely the arbitrariness argument, does not have a fully directive form. It just points out that talents are arbitrary from a moral point of view. It does not require that people do a particular thing at all times. And so therefore, my version of the argument does not encounter this version of the demandingness problem. And hence, there's no need to invoke a personal prerogative or to tackle the difficulties associated with it, which include how large it should be, whether the prerogative can be invoked to serve any end or only some ends. Instead, on my view, although citizens cannot act on the motive of leveraging their talents, they can act on a variety of other motives that do not offend the stricture that their motives are compatible with the arbitrariness argument. Freedom from a fully directed principle and the availability of a wide range of other permissible motives and ends answers to the demandingness concern without lending the appearance or grappling with a structure that seems to grant a holiday for moral requirements, as a personal prerogative does. But there's a second version of the demandingness problem that attaches both to my account and to Jerry's, that hinges upon the scope of individual responsibility for policing the influence of morally arbitrary factors on one's income and wealth. This problem is raised by the question of whether you're constrained not merely from demanding benefits when you're in the position to make demands, but also whether you're constrained from accepting benefits when you suspect that they may be offered, though you haven't solicited them, on the basis of one's arbitrary possession, though those benefits do not wear their provenance on their face and there are no ready alternatives. That situation, the one I've just described, may be the one more commonly faced than the personal negotiations Jerry initially focused on. Incentive payments often are not the products of direct demands in face-to-face bargaining situations. They often arise indirectly through the operation of gross structural mechanisms rather than fine-grained reactions. As some have celebrated and others have lamented, the individualized contract has by and large been replaced by standard form terms. And so this raises the question of whether the internalization of the arbitrariness argument requires that one police the causal history of all offers and benefits and that one refuse all offers and benefits that have suspect credentials. Such a requirement, as I alluded before, raises a different kind of demanding this issue. So let me illustrate by returning to race. It's not that burdensome to ask citizens to refrain from acting on racist motives, and to refrain from presenting racist reasons for claims, and to refrain from taking advantage of others' racism. But it may present more of a burden on individuals that they attempt to investigate and discern why various opportunities are available to them, to refuse those opportunities even when the alternatives are significantly worse, to disentangle themselves from all structures that provide standard reasonable goods but contingently have racist origins, and to do so on one's own in an uncoordinated fashion with uncertainty about how others are acting, uncertainty generated in part by the epistemic unclarity of what and how much to do. The burdens are partly that these efforts are extremely attention and energy and time consuming. They're partly that a citizen whose actions and motives themselves have been innocent have to bear this burden, and partly that it may require constant creativity when there are no clearly satisfactory options in a social structure organized around this causal history. Similar burdens present themselves if we ask individuals to try to assess whether their salary levels reflect appropriate compensation for relative labor burden, appropriate compensation for a more limited range of labor opportunities, early adjustments for pending cost of living increases or inflation, or unreasonable compensation for talent. If it's unreasonable to ask individuals to devote indefinite amounts of energy to this investigatory task, then there are also burdens associated with attempting to assess what the right balance is and whether that balance should be altered depending on others' assessments. One response to these concerns is to take the view that the basic structure should handle these problems rather than asking individuals to sort them out. But this may seem unsatisfying when we're aware that the government cannot tackle these burdens alone, and if this case is really the standard case and negotiation is the exception. If we agree that talents are arbitrary with respect to income distributions, and hence people are structures who directly or indirectly, consciously or unconsciously treat them as non-arbitrary or unjust, then we may be pushed into thinking that a basic structure solution plus a bar on actively taking talents to supply a reason leaves gaps of injustice. Individual citizens who internalize the arbitrariness argument will confront potentially overwhelming demands to ensure that they do not intentionally or unintentionally participate in taking advantage of an arbitrary characteristic. It may seem that either my reconfigured critique of labor incentives again faces the demanding this objection, or, like Jerry's account, has to incorporate a personal prerogative. Now, this situation should already be familiar to us. It's not one only faced in ideal theory. We face difficulties like this all the time in our own lives. Vegans wonder whether their food or wine depended on animal products. Was the wine filtered through egg whites or the sugar through charcoal? Vegetarians wonder whether the pans were also used for meat. And all of us have reason to wonder whether their consumer products emerged from pathways of fair labor or not. But although I suggested a minute ago that there's a dichotomy that either you face the demandingness objection or you use a personal prerogative, I don't think the choices are that dichotomous. I don't think that either we're actually under overwhelming demands to investigate the provenance of everything we consume or to invent new products when no satisfactory ones emerged, or that we explain this freedom by reference to a personal prerogative to ignore what would otherwise be legitimate moral demands. Instead, I think what we should ask is whether the form of our duties not to benefit from opaque mechanisms that privilege talent takes the same form as our duty not to directly take advantage of talent. And I suggest that the duties take different forms. We cannot actively treat something as a reason that we accept is not a reason. That duty admits of no exception. It's not subject to a prerogative. If we're required not to kill animals for food, we can't order meat or order food knowing it will be infused by meat. This would be to treat a product as choice-worthy that we know is not. Likewise, I can't engage in just a little bit of racism or conscious collaboration with racists because I need the money for a really important personal project. But where the relations to illicit factors are complex, indirect, and opaque, or where there are not clear alternatives, it's less clear to me that accepting a benefit whose causal history is infused with the influence of illicit factors violates the stricture not to treat something as a reason that is not a reason. I'm not, in these cases, choosing to take advantage of a feature I should not. I'm rather bombarded by that feature. The structure of the problem seems to demand a more collective, coordinated response. If you know illicit factors work in the background and do so for everyone, then you have reason to support coordinated efforts to control the influence of these factors. And the government is not the only collective organization that may do so. Organized boycotts may make hidden factors salient and exert pressure that provides a more uniform response and uniform burdens on the citizen. Boycotts of products may then place pressure on the supply lines of yet other products, initiating reform through the power of suggestion and precedent. In labor markets, the elements of the basic structure may not be as simple as employers and market regulations. Unions can play a role in establishing practices that constrain the illicit influence of talent on salary, as well as race and gender on salary, by, for example, establishing standard pay scales. Although unions are mostly associated with efforts to gain greater benefits for workers, they also serve to counter pressure from markets and employers to treat workers differentially, and they may serve as inlets of information closer to workers' experience to help distinguish what claims rest on higher labor burden and what claims originate from market pressures. I will end by reframing the fledgling point I've been pursuing over the past 10 minutes. In essence, I've been arguing that there's a perfect duty to refrain from actively treating talents as though they provided reasons for higher or lesser income. I've suggested, then, that the matter is more difficult with respect to how we should conceive of the additional obligations we have to avoid merely benefiting from practices that reflect arbitrary factors, but which may be opaque, nearly ubiquitous, or otherwise difficult to avoid. If we do conceive of the duty not to benefit from practices that reflect arbitrary factors as a perfect one, then we will encounter a hefty version of the demanding this problem. But the concerns that underlie both the arbitrariness argument and the demanding this problem are the interest in ensuring that the moral and political structure makes sufficient room for each of us to pursue our own conception of the good and to live the life of a free and equal person. This gives us a lot of reason to think that the relevant duty in the case of merely accepting benefits that reflect a causal history involving an illicit factor, that duty couldn't be a perfect duty, and rather it must take something like the shape of an imperfect duty. Now, that lands us in very familiar, though still murky, territory. We always have reason to promote the value that underwrites an imperfect duty, but we need not and could not promote it on every possible occasion. But as individuals, we can't ignore it entirely either. As with beneficence, our imperfect duties may be specifically triggered on discrete occasions when the values at stake are very evident or salient. As with beneficence, our constant interest in the underlying value gives us reason to try to promote collective social structures that will attend to this value regularly, where we as individuals have to fall short of promoting it adequately, whether for good reasons or poor reasons. As with beneficence, these social collective structures may take a multiplicity of forms, both governmental and non-governmental. So, as I've reframed the problem, the issues we confront within a Rawlsian well-ordered society are much more continuous with the issues we already confront in daily non-ideal theory. I find this a welcome result. It suggests that what we may learn in thinking about labor incentives within a society governed by the two principles should cross-fertilize how we now confront and handle more contemporary problems in which we all benefit from structures that unfortunately bear little resemblance to those we'd encounter in a more just society, and vice versa. And this makes a lot of sense to me. Jerry's intervention was initially introduced as a criticism not just of a particular suggestion of Rawls's, but of Thatcher's tax cuts and of contemporary interpersonal manifestations of class dynamics. And so it seems only fitting to end at this juncture because it reminds me of yet further virtues of Jerry's we should celebrate: his very fine-grained sensitivity to the philosophical undercurrents underneath the local and the personal, combined with his uncanny ability to bring large abstract arguments to bear on them in very simple and compelling ways.
Well, thank you very much for that, Shauna, and we'll go straight over to Dick Anderson, who will offer a comment. So take it away, Dick.
I don't know G.A. Cohen personally well at all. I know him, unlike most people. I know him mainly through his writings. And so as a reader, like many, I'm enormously in his debt. There's no living moral philosopher, very few dead ones, from whose writings I've learned more or gained more enjoyment, and no philosopher's writings have I found more intricate, brilliant arguments to continuously compel my admiration. But rightly or wrongly, the academic is judged also by the quality of his students, his graduate students. And as we've seen in this conference, Jerry Cohen's PhD students and graduate students, the people he supervised, are an amazing, talented, productive, interesting, wonderful bunch of philosophers, including the author of the president's paper. So I'm Shauna Schifrin, whom I've been a fan for a long time. So I'm delighted and honored to be commenting on the paper. So Shauna Schifrin reinterprets and amends Cohen's famous incentives argument. Against Cohen, she accepts that the difference principle is a norm for the regulation of the basic structure, and as such does not regulate individual choices within that structure. However, she observes that persons in a well-ordered society will accept the principles of justice, together with their justifications, quoting from Schifrin, the major justification of the difference principle is that distributions of social primary goods should not reflect factors that are arbitrary from a moral point of view. And then she adds that the fact that one possesses some special skill or talent is in this context arbitrary from a moral point of view. Accepting this, one cannot take possession of talent to be a reason when one takes action that aims at affecting the distribution of social primary goods. She makes here an illuminating analogy with race, which she says is on the same way morally arbitrary in this context. The upshot, according to Schifrin, is that, quoting, if we are to treat possessions of talent as arbitrary factors with respect to one's claim on the joint social product, just as we are to treat race, then similarly I should not ask for nor take advantage of higher salaries offered on account of my possession of a favored talent, nor should employers offer such higher salaries. Schifrin suggests that her version of the against incentives position may be superior to Cohen's canonical or usual formulation of it, and that her version travels lighter. She gets a conclusion somewhat similar to those for which Cohen argues, without relying on such morally controversial premises as those in which his version of the argument relies, and in particular, she does not need to argue that the principles chosen for the basic structure apply directly also to individuals and determine to some extent what they must do to be fully compliant with the requirements of justice, and we also avoid the problems with their personal prerogative. This is a fascinating argument, I've just been summarizing, and I'm still just beginning to reflect on it. So what follows are tentative, provisional thoughts. I agree you could accept the egalitarian deontological requirement that Schifrin affirms. It's a coherent claim. But the premises needed to support it, though not yet fully spelled out by her, definitely strike me as implausible, in any way, more controversial than the alternative premises to which Cohen must appeal. So I'm confining myself here to a claim of comparative plausibility. You might think Cohen's arguments to his favorite conclusion are more plausible than Schifrin's to hers, even if you thought, as I do, that neither argument succeeds. So first, I accept Cohen's guiding thought that our fundamental concern should be neither the basic structure of society in any sense, nor people's individual choices, but the pattern of benefits and burdens in society. Cohen again. Distributed justice is, quoting, justice and its lack in the distribution of benefits and burdens to individuals. Now, if that's something, I would say that it immediately follows that the just society, for instance, would lower tax rates on hiring individuals if the result was a greater fulfillment of the difference principle than any choice of an alternative tax schedule. Near EO yesterday gave one scenario. Another one might just be, this might come about in a variety of ways. Suppose the mechanism is philanthropy. With lower tax rates on high earners, they give more to global poverty relief, and the difference principle understood as having global scope would be better fulfilled. I don't say the scenario was likely or plausible, just that if the facts were as specified, the difference principle would dictate a tax rate that anticipates how individuals would respond in their choices to that tax rate. But then I don't see why leveraging one's special talent to gain higher pay should be regarded as per se a deontological wrong, according to Schifrin. If Sally, a higher-earning lawyer, can bargain to earn even more, intending to increase her contribution to global poverty relief, the maxim on which she acts does not contradict the justification of the difference principle, I say. Schifrin might object that I'm really just imagining coping strategies that apply in a massively unjust world. She's really doing ideal theory, not non-ideal theory, but I don't see this. In principle, in the perfectly just society that achieves the global difference principle by making the worst off as well off as they can be made, just accepting Walzerism here for a minute, the philanthropic choices of high-earning individuals might be part of the stable mechanism that secures social justice. She'll reject this. She'll hold that it's forbidden, just as it's forbidden to commit racist acts, even in order to promote the goal of reducing racism overall. Similarly, it's forbidden to seek gain from possession of talent, even to promote social justice goals. So, I mean, just on the face of it, I mean, I don't see the two cases as on a par. I mean, even if being racist in order to promote non-racism is wrong, I don't see that Sally's accepting incentive pay to help the global poor relief is wrong in any respect. Even if it was a proton, it was wrong. There's a further implausibility. I think Schifrin's position seems implausible in its absolutism. It's a deontological rule that, with it, if it properly understood, holds come what may. Why always wrong, all things considered? She explicitly states that it would be wrong, for example, for an employer to offer higher pay to induce a more able applicant to take a job, even if the employer was doing this purely in order to bring about a greater fulfillment of the difference principle. Presumably she thinks this holds no matter how great the social justice gains that are at stake, lost if one insists on standing fast by her proposed rule. Again, I don't object to absolutism per se. I mean, the idea that there are moral principles to which one ought always to conform, even a pluralist act consequentialist like me holds that there are moral principles, namely pluralist act consequentialist principles, to which one ought always to conform. I have no quarrel with rallying behind an absolutist banner. I just strongly disagree with where Schifrin plants it. So there's an issue. I don't quite understand exactly the shape of this deontological rule. I mean, there are quite, I mean, just for a second, I'll explore this. This is tended. Here it may just be my confusion. I haven't got it right. I'm going to learn from you and from her. As opposed to take some other examples. Consider small entrepreneurs who get their living by making products and selling them, or by performing services for fees. As a consumer, I face an array of such products and services, some better, some worse. Suppose I patronize the best baker, I do, and the best laundry in my neighborhood. I facilitate their greater financial gain due to their greater ability. Is this forbidden? Suppose I face a career choice. I could be a rather incompetent baker or a very competent car mechanic, I wish, but I choose the latter to increase my income. Is this forbidden? In both cases, we can distinguish maybe intending to bring about incentive pay and merely having that as a foreseen but intended consequence of what I do. So not all, some information suggests that it's, you know, it's the double, it's intending, whether it's one's goal or means to one's goal, an evil, that that's what's strictly forbidden. Other times she says it's active versus passive. I'm not sure. So in the consumer case, suppose my aim is to eat better bread and my means is purchasing it. That the competent baker prospers may be a foreseen but unintended side effect. It's not, you know, so there. So then the question would be, you know, sort of double, then in double effect terms, presumably there'd have to be due proportionality between the good that's gained and the evil that comes about as foreseen but unintended. But I mean, is that the structure? I mean, not all our formulations suggest that. And the career choice, again, I might see, it's same kind of point. I'm not sure how strict would this really imply for one's permissible behavior in a market economy? I mean, you might decompose the choice of lucrative career into two separate acts, pursuing the career of competent baker and one taking extra pay, resources for oneself in virtue of one's superior competence. Granted, one might be okay according to Schifrin on certain understandings. Why is two ever okay? Maybe I'll just always just accept at most the average pay in society. I'm just not sure about that. So that possession of ability. Granted, point here is I'm not sure about quite the right characterization of the deontological rule, but I know I don't like it, whatever exactly its characterization is. That possession of ability is morally arbitrary with respect to the division of the benefits and burdens of economic cooperation. That might mean, there are different construals here, and it's up for grabs. It might mean that possession of ability is not a justifying reason for extra resources, but that could be compatible with thinking that it might be a permissible motivating reason sometimes. That's one possibility, which I think is true in our world. Also, another possibility, the fact that the possession of ability is not per se intrinsically in itself a reason in this context of affecting the distribution of gains from economic production, that doesn't yet establish that it can't sometimes combine with other factors to constitute a legitimate reason. So, you know, you're possessing skill by itself might be morally arbitrary, and so leveraging that is bad. But that plus other stuff might be a good reason. Incentive pay can serve a useful economic function that attracts labor to where it's more productive. So far as I can see, incentive pay is morally permissible, I think morally required, in a well-ordered society that's run on Rawlsian Cohenite principles. The egalitarian ethos that citizens internalize, taking on the goal of to some extent, advancing the fulfillment of the difference principle in one's personal choices, the egalitarian ethos that citizens internalize does not rule out economic activity motivated by desire for personal gain. The ethos limits but does not eliminate self-seeking. Acceptance of the Scheffler prerogative gives self-seeking a legitimate place. In a society in which people internalize the ethos and the prerogative, each makes economic choices, sometimes or in part, with the aim of bringing about greater fulfillment of the difference principle. But to some degree, sometimes, each is free to pursue her own aims, including the aim of bargaining for advantage within the limits of the deontological constraint. If you just accept that there is this, given the difference, there's some, as Kant would put it, an objective end, there's a worthy goal that you must pursue to some extent in your life, take on as a goal, namely the fulfillment of justice. But you don't want to go maximizing or act consequentialist here. You want to be reasonable. You want the requirement to be moderate. Then it's just you just have to buy into the personal prerogative. I mean, it's not mysterious. It's not a get out of jail free card or a moral holiday. It just says that given that we there's this noble goal, this justice goal that we should all pursue in our lives, you don't have to do it to the max. You have to do it to a good enough degree. So there's the best you could do, and then the various acts you could do that would produce less than that. And the requirement is just, I'm not sure if it's each individual act or over the course of your life. Schiffen raises a good point. The prerogative has got to be theorized more. But excuse me, it's not bad. The strategy is it's not mysterious at all. So the basic idea is just that you've got this freedom. You have to do something that's good enough. You don't have to do the best. And you've got freedom to do anything in this range. As far as that goes, I think that's quite plausible. And it's not a moral license to do anything. It operates within moral constraints. No murdering, no stealing, and so on. Right? So incentive pay is not categorically forbidden in a well-ordered RC. Oh, Rawlsian Cohenite society. The nuns taught me Roman Catholic. So. Indeed, I would say it's required sometimes in situations that Schiffen describes, where one is not obligated to take a job that better fulfills the difference principle, but could be induced by higher pay to do so. Schiffen's position, as I understand it, is categoric against incentives then, and Cohen's is not. This seems to me a big point in favor of Cohen's version. There can be legitimate reasons to treat possession of ability as a reason with respect to distribution of resources, I think. Schiffen is not troubled by the fact that in a well-ordered society run according to Rawlsian Schiffrenian RS principles, justice may require acceptance of Pareto suboptimal outcomes. I don't share her equanimity. In my view, so in the trilemma between equality, freedom, and Pareto, she happily gives up Pareto. But in my view, Pareto optimality is no great thing. It's not God to worship. It's a minimal fairness condition, a component of a full norm of fairness. If we can make Shauna better off without making anybody else worse off, and those are the only alternatives, those are just our two choices, it's just unfair to Shauna if we don't make her better off. And that's part of fairness. Our commitment to Pareto optimality requires us to prefer, for instance, the Lexeman to the non-Lexeman version of the difference principle. Finally, I don't regard it as true that possession of ability to do a job better than another is always morally arbitrary, just in itself, not a justifying reason with respect to the fair division of resources. Let me just gesture at two things. In some cases, your superior ability, your superior skill, reflects the fact that you put forth persistent efforts to develop your native talents and skills, and sometimes, in some contexts, this renders you morally more deserving of higher pay, I say. You could also go for option luck version of this, option luck considerations. You and I, we both have the opportunity, same talent, same native talent, same loving parents, same everything, same educational opportunities. I majored in English, you majored in engineering. Your skills are in greater demand. Your option set is greater. That's just differential option luck, even though we both worked equally hard in college. The inequality in our economic resources that arises seems to me might be morally acceptable, not just the fact that you've got greater skill than I do. That might be a legitimate reason. I just don't accept the basic point. And then going back to this idea of morally, is it problematic that justice involves not just deontological constraint, but this goal that we must pursue, as in Cohen's version? I don't accept that the analogy to race. This will be my final point. I don't see that the racism example works in Schiffrin's favor, as she supposes. let's suppose, with Schifrin, that fundamental principles of egalitarian justice should include a flat prohibition against racial discrimination. I disagree, but that's irrelevant. Let's see what follows. She thinks the justification will be that justification of racial characteristics is arbitrary from the moral point of view and should play no role in the determination and distribution of the benefits and burdens of social cooperation. She thinks accepting this justification commits me to not treating racial characteristic possession as a reason in a context in which it's not a reason. This does not commit me to adopting the goal of bringing it about that the just ideal of a non-racist society is fulfilled, or fulfilled to a threshold acceptable extent, or fulfilled to the greatest possible extent. But look, I mean, if the difference principle is justified, or if the non-racism principle is justified, just take the difference principle. There's going to be a justification for the norm that society should arrange its basic structure with a view to fulfilling the goal of advancing the prospects of the worst off. You got to get premises that get you get a goal in there. This is compatible. That's compatible with the priority of the fulfillment of higher party justice principles. And if a similar anti-racism principle is fundamental, it's going to justify the norm that society should arrange its basic structure with a view to fulfilling the goal of making human social affairs untainted with racism to the greatest possible extent. In both cases, whatever arguments justify embrace of the moral goals will have to include other premises besides the premise asserting the possession of racial characteristics or the possession of ability characteristics is not a reason for action in certain contexts. The full justification of the difference principle is going to have to include premises that justify promoting a goal. Same goes, as far as I can see, for Schifrin's proposed Rawlsian anti-racism principle. But then I just don't see why she doesn't accept, and given that social justice is the fair distribution of benefits and burdens among the relevant set of individuals, that the full justification of the principles for the basic structure doesn't also justify embrace by individuals of justice-required goals for individual conduct. Again, they don't have to take an act consequential shape. They might be a requirement to promote goals up to some threshold level. I acknowledge I'm gesturing in the dark here because Schifrin has not set out her own account of the full set of premises that warrants choice of the difference principle or the anti-racism principle, nor have I offered any alternative account. But I don't see how the justification of Cohenite Rawlsian principles of justice can eschew premises that support promotion of just roles as well as respect for just constraints. I'll just stop.
Make some